Hey, it's Andrew. Just quickly before we start this episode, I want to tell you about one of my favorite podcasts, the Secure Ventures podcast. The host, Kyle McNulty, interviews cybersecurity founders about what they are building. I enjoy it because Kyle focuses on their technology, what it solves, why they build it, where it fits in the market. Also, listeners can understand the why of these startups. In some ways, it's a great complement to my own podcast where I focus on the go-to-market side, not the technology side. He's had some great guests on recently, for example, the CEO of Reality Defender, when they talked about the ins and outs of deepfake detection. He's had the co-founder and CEO of Ghost Security, and also the co-founder of Radical, Chris Peterson, who was incidentally a founder of Logrhythm, where they talk about the role of AI in the SOC. This is not a paid promotion. I just simply enjoy what Kyle is doing with his interviews and get a lot out of them. Check it out. It's the Secure Ventures podcast. Now on with this episode. If you've been selling at all for any length of time, you know how deals can get completely stuck if you don't have the relevant security controls and assessments in place to pass the vendor assessments that your prospects will put you through, especially if you're selling into highly regulated industries such as finance and healthcare and defense, things like that. But when should a startup start doing this? And how do they go about doing it? Kane McLadry joins us today to demystify this whole area. Kane has been a practitioner, a CISO. He's led consulting organizations at vendors, and now he is the field CISO at Hyperproof. So if you don't like your deals getting stuck or slowed down in procurement, don't miss this episode. Welcome to the Cybersecurity Startup Revenue Podcast, where we help cybersecurity companies grow revenue faster. I am your host, Andrew Monahan. Our guest today is Kane McLadry, Field CISO at Hyperproof. Kane, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on the show today, Andrew.
I'm looking forward to this, Kane. You're not our usual type of guest. You're very different. Your background is that you've been a practitioner in security. You've been a CISO in security. You've been on the vendor side where you've led and built professional services and implementation organizations. And right now, of course, you're the field CISO at Hyperproof. But we're going to get into an area I think that some startups wrestle with, which is, you know, we're pretty small, but, you know, we want to win some big customers. We want to do the right thing in terms of our own risk posture. At what point should we start investing in getting some security folks on board? When should we start going for things such as SOC 2 to get the credibility we need to win big customers? So it's a whole area I think that companies, early stage companies, kind of wrestle with. So I'm looking forward to having your perspective on all that area. All right, well, let's continue with the business side of this. So Kane, Field CISO is a title or something like that that's been around for a little bit, but you know, not that long, right? Going back 10, 15 years, it wasn't something that was all that common. But now it seems more and more common. I thought that since you were on, I'd get a bit more thoughts about, you know, being in the field CISO role. What exactly are you doing day to day? What value do you bring to the organization? Give us a sense of what it's all about.
So I think the field CISO role is a recognition on the part of companies, including Hyperproof, where I'm at, to separate out the role that a CISO would typically or a CISO would typically do. So a lot of companies have this expectation that the CISO is going to be the person who can talk to the board and they can write Python code and they can do incident response and they can manage a multi-million dollar budget and they can do all of that somehow in a 26-hour day, only 8 days a week. And I think that forward-looking companies, there was a fintech I worked with down in the Atlanta area, maybe 5 years ago, where they had separated the CISO role out into three distinct parts. They had the policy person who was responsible for ongoing governance. They had the implementation person who was, responsible for making sure controls were getting implemented, not actually implementing them themselves. And then they had the public-facing person, wasn't named a field CISO, but their goal was to separate people out based on their unique strengths and their unique talents. And when I moved from being a traditional CISO to becoming a field CISO, I tell you, it's a bit of a joy because I've previously done things like ITAR and ISO and FedRAMP and so on and so forth. And at Hyperproof, I'm buttressed actually by my co-host on Drafting Compliance, one of our podcasts, Tom, who is responsible for our FedRAMP uplift. Because I was offered, hey, do you want to, in addition to doing field CISO work, do you want to do FedRAMP policy development work and implementation? I was like, yeah, no, I've already got enough gray hair. I think I'm good on that front. So a lot of what I do is evangelism or outreach associated to the media, a lot of earned media, as well as podcast appearances, media appearances, talking at conventions, as well as talking to investors and prospects occasionally to really look at where compliance operations fits into an organization's day-to-day operations and how it could be an improvement for them, or alternatively, if it is not even vaguely a good fit. I think there's a lot of companies out there that right now are trying to figure how to talk about risk effectively, how to communicate it, how to measure it, how to proactively act on it. I think those are the companies where, they're a natural fit for Hyperproof. It's a great conversation with me about that. And there's other companies where they still think that cybersecurity is an IT problem. Those are the ones where if I can't change their mind, at least I can give them the idea that it's not just an IT problem that we're out to solve here.
And I love the idea that the skill set to go and do what you do right now, be talking, be meeting with people, be influencing them, evangelizing, isn't always a skill set as a person who's used to doing some Python coding, right? Sometimes it's not their bailiwick to go out there and be more public, right?
Definitely. I think the other thing that, and this is possibly a cautionary tale, to be a field CISO, I think there's an entry criteria that you have to have previously done the job. Because you're going to be meeting and talking to other CISOs and to other senior executives. And that is a very different conversation than when you're leading an implementation team, or alternatively, if you're doing work in the trenches, or if you just come from, I don't know, a straight communications major or marketing background, you might have the ability to speak, but you might not understand the context and the broader outlook of where things are going right now. Consequently, so in addition to doing CISO work, I mean, I spend an inordinate amount of time reading law journals, probably more than I should. If you see me on LinkedIn, you'll see a lot of my stuff comes from law journals these days, rather than technology journals, because I think, as you said, like a lot of cybersecurity vendors aren't really doing anything bold. And a lot of the more interesting work I'm seeing right now is legislative or regulatory, and that's in response to a potential market failure associated with innovation and actually making meaningful investment in cybersecurity.
And are you joined to the hip with the sales team, or are you got a wall between you guys and you kind of do your own thing?
The sales team and I get on pretty well. I think that I'm aligned as, executive operations. So I'm in the executive team, but I've spent, I think the marketing team pays my bar tab, bless them for that. They also send me to events, and, the sales team has, the ability to get me on calls, can work with me as necessary, but it's not a direct one-to-one relationship.
Right. Right. Okay. But if I was in the sales team at Hyperproof, I would love the fact that I've got someone in the company who has credibility and the ability to go and engage with people extremely well and be influential with them, right? Without having the sales in their title. Seemed to me that'd be a weapon that I would want to have.
I think that's a fair assessment.
Remember, the first time I heard about this, I think years, probably 2015 or so, Malcolm Harkins left. He was the CISO at Intel. And I think it was Intel, and he left there to become, I forget what his title was, field CISO, like something like that at Cylance in the early days. He must have known Stuart McClure from various things, and he became that role there. And I remember that time thinking, that makes a ton of sense. I really like that idea. If I was in the sales team, I would think, yeah, I want more people like that than necessarily, I don't know, another email campaign for my marketing team.
Yeah, I think the other challenge with being a field CISO, and I actually convene a field CISO roundtable, invite-only activity. I think the thing we all collectively struggle with as field CISOs is not being salesy. So I am not a picks and clicks guy. If you want to talk to me about the macroeconomic portrait of here's how things are trending across the world and here's possible strategies that we could use, sure. Cool. If you want to talk about business level risks associated with that, awesome, cool, fun. If you want to talk to me about why our product is the best thing, no, sorry, wrong, not me. I certainly have a strong opinion. That's why I joined the company. But it's that not like I don't carry a quota, and I've only ever met one field CISO who did, and they recognized at the time that it was a bit of a squidgy fit. I think that all of the field CISOs I know are fairly broad brush. We are all former CISOs. We all have that breadth of experience to be able to figure out, like, does this solution that you're looking at make any logical sense for your business? Or should you be looking at something else? Should you have table stakes things in? Because something we're good at doing in cybersecurity is selling shiny widgets that don't necessarily solve business problems. They just solve people's sale quota reduction problems, which doesn't actually help the company that bought it necessarily. Like, there's a lot of point solutions out there that I, despite having seen them, I keep looking at them and going, yeah, you're an acquisition target. You're an acquisition target. So if you do a relationship with them, right, contractually, just expect they won't exist in 2 years and you'll be negotiating with somebody else.
Yeah, yeah. Final thought on this area that, back to your point about trying to draw that line between not trying to be the salesperson or the SE, but trying to have a different view. One of the things we talked about before is the idea that when someone thinks that you or your company just absolutely understands the problems they're facing inside and out, without even having to talk about your product, they just intuitively think you have also have the solution. Right? And it seems to me that many vendors, especially salespeople, are not good at that. You know, let me be the expert around the problem. They believe their role is to be expert on the product and therefore the solution. And it seems like, you know, what you would bring is that gravitas, the experience, the title to say, yeah, we're going to show that we absolutely understand the problem inside and out.
And part of that also comes with working with product management, which is another aspect of my role at Hyperproof, where I have the privilege of talking to people who are, you know, our designers for each aspect of the product and the solution. So I have a conversation, for example, with our risk designer, who's responsible for both first party and third party risk, or for the person who's responsible for our audit function or for our framework function. And in those, I can bring the perspective of this is, as a CISO, what I'd be looking for. If you're going to show me a dashboard that shows me my first party and third party risks, here's the elements that I need, and here's what I need to be able to draw from that, and here's what I need to go into my board meeting with, because I've done that before. And I've also done executive advisory before, where I've seen CISOs struggle with tooling to actually get a deck together to put in front of their board. It tends to be a common problem. But also in terms of future product evolution, we recently closed our Series B, and there are conversations now on, like, the whole world is talking about generative AI, right? And I fully anticipate the next RSA is going to be a lot of lipstick wearing pigs. And my conversations with product are, let's not do that, please, right? Let's look at, if we're going to invest in generative AI, let's actually have it be sensible. Like, nobody wants a chatbot to say, how do I build a compliance program? That's a nonsense feature. Now, some people might choose to build that into their product. To me, I think there's more thoughtful applications. The work that I might have put on an associate consultant for evaluating evidence for adequacy and sufficiency, for example, that's something that I think AI could be helpful for, but you can't just throw AI, put it on your booth at RSA and say, job done, because we all tried that with zero trust. And we saw exactly how you know, burned and cursed of a term that's become. And I'm trying to steer the conversation on, let's be deliberate here. Let's not just jump on the bandwagon with everyone else.
Well, I can tell you're very passionate about the different facets of your role and as a field CISO. You know, there's two or three really exciting areas that you're working on, and you don't have to worry about audits and things like that like you might have had to do in previous lives.
This is very true. Yes. It's a joy.
Final question on that, though. When you joined Hyperproof, what employee number were you? How early did you come on?
Oh, boy.
Roughly.
I don't actually know. I think somewhere in the 50s.
Okay. So I would say that's quite early, right? I mean, it's you know, I would imagine the management team there were quite thoughtful then about what this role would be like and what it would do. You don't see many roughly 50 employee startups employing someone in this role. I wish more would do it. Because I think there's a lot, especially now where a lot of the old ways of, you know, generating pipe seem to be not working nearly as well as they used to, having someone knowledgeable and known and trustworthy in the community, out there advocating for the problem, you know, and solving it. It must be a huge value to organizations if they could move a couple of SDR headcount, for example, two or three, to bring in someone like yourself. I would imagine they get much more bigger bang for their buck. But Kane, let's move on to the original premise of the discussion, which was we're going to continue with the idea of this company we've been talking about, this fictitious company, Cyber Donut. Cyber Donut is a vendor. They've got roughly, you know, 5 to 8 reps on board. They've got their first 20 customers. They're growing nicely, right? But, you know, they want to go after big companies now. They're going after enterprises, maybe financial services, banking, defense contractors, things like that. And somewhere along the line, they've realized or are about to realize they're going to be asked questions in the vendor survey or as part of the procurement process. So where are you guys at with your own risk and compliance program? And they're going to ask a whole bunch of questions that you might have to answer no to, which is not good in terms of getting selection. And you know, so therefore, at what point should Cyber Donut be saying, you know, we need to do this. We need to figure out what we do. How do we approach it? You know, so how do you advise companies such as Cyber Donut to start thinking about this whole area?
So there's, I'm going to oversimplify this and put it into like 3 distinct steps or 3 distinct phases. And I think the impetus for this is not necessarily cybersecurity, which might come as a surprise from me, but it comes down to, we've had a persistent narrative in the industry of cybersecurity as a cost center. It's a black hole, if you will, into which you pour money and effort and only breaches come out. And I think that's the wrong way of thinking about our industry and the discipline of cybersecurity as well. It is actually a competitive sales differentiator. And I think that as companies start to not even sell up market at this point, when you're in the mid-market, there is a lot of there's this emphasis on third-party risk and supply chain risk that has become pervasive in the past few years, where as companies are acquiring products or solutions, a lot of companies are using questionnaires, which can really decelerate and really slow down and really become an obstacle that causes companies to miss their financials because the deal didn't close, because they're still filling out the questionnaire, or they're going back and forth on the questionnaire, or the company wants to send their own assessor to do an evaluation. And so I think as companies start to initially bump into that, it only gets worse. That one does not ever get better. And so I want to talk through kind of the 3 things that make that feasible and survivable for a small company. And the first one, the first is really kind of table stakes. Pick a table stakes framework, something like the Center for Internet Security's Critical Security Controls Implementation Group 1. That's super bare bones, easy. Like if you are not doing these basic things, you probably are not going to be in business for a very long period of time, because you're going to have either reputational issues, or you're just going to get breached and get rolled up and like all your infrastructure gets burned. But I also think that as companies look at that, or I don't know, NIST CSF has some prescriptive controls now for like early stage companies. There are others as well. Don't necessarily think that you have to buy all the shiny products, and don't necessarily think that you need to do it yourself. And the reason why is, even though these are like the bare minimum for a company to have trust of their customers and earn the trust of their prospects, you don't have to staff that, because there's a talent war going on right now, and there's a product war going on right now, where there are a lot of cybersecurity salaries tend to be higher than market average. And also products do tend to get more expensive over time. And so I think the first thing is look for a service provider, a managed security service provider, an MSSP, instead of trying to fight that talent war, right? Try and see which of these controls, and when I say control, now this is the former auditor in me coming out, a control is people, process, or technology. We always in this industry focus on that third element of, oh, look, shiny technology. No, it can be a person, it can be a process, or it could be a technology. And for those where the MSSP can provide that, heck yes, have them do that as much as possible so that your company can focus on your core business value and your core business strategy and implementation and engineering, rather than like, how are we operating all of these security controls in as lightweight a fashion as possible?
And should they bring in someone then as a FTE to work on this? And even though they might work with MSSPs, things like that, or is this something an outside consultant could help them with?
I think if before your Series A, or maybe even in your Series A, this is something where the MSSP, if it's a reputable managed security service provider, they're going to have the staff and the time. Of course, now you can work out the time allocation that you get from your MSSP, but they're going to have that ability. So I don't think this is a dedicated FTE. I think that the only dedicated FTE you might have on this one is your IT person, who's going to be working alongside the MSSP for any implementation details that they have.
Got it. So they're the ones you can turn to drive it at the start before you get to maybe A or B, B running level of funding. And by picking a framework, you're basically answering one of the first questions that you'll get, which is, what do you base your program on, right? And if it's a shrug of the shoulders, it's whatever Jimmy thought would be a good idea. That's not necessarily what they're looking for, right? So even just by saying, you know, CIS or NIST or whatever, you start to build up some credibility that you're thinking about things correctly, right?
Yes, and that actually also has knock-on benefits. If you're a business in Connecticut or Iowa or Utah or Ohio, you get an affirmative tort defense. Because the legislatures there have realized, like, if you're trying to do reasonable cybersecurity and your policies say you're following literally something better than what Joe, who lives in the basement, told you to go do, ISO, CIS, NIST, don't care, HIPAA, they will actually say, you know what, if you get a derivative lawsuit, you don't have to deal with that. It's just a get out of jail. That won't help in criminal proceedings, and this is not legal advice. However, it does recognize the value of that, so there are knock-on benefits associated with that.
Got it. So first step is pick your framework. Second step.
And a partner to actually help you with the implementation of that. So the next bit of it is on the creation of a corporate risk register. Now you might be thinking, wait a second, he's a former CISO, he's a field CISO, and he says create a corporate risk register. And I'm saying that because I don't think that a business risk is different than a cyber risk. I think that if you think of, let's take a tornado, for example. Let's say you have manufacturing capabilities in a location where tornadoes are a thing that happens. You can put a lot of controls in place. You can have reasonable, I don't know, building codes. You can build in maybe an area which is less susceptible to be hit by a tornado, but it's, you know, there's still that risk that happens. Similarly, you could have a ransomware attack, or you could have an extortion attack, or you could have some kind of cyber attack. In both cases, your outcome was you don't have manufacturing capabilities at this point. Now, that's one was the cyber risk, one was the business risk. No, there's no such thing as a cyber risk. Cyber is an influence on business risks more than anything else. And the thing that I've found in years of talking to companies about risks, if people don't agree on the definition of words, you're not going to have a productive conversation. And so get everybody who is a stakeholder in risks, and this is not a cyber exercise at all. What does the word low mean? What does the word high mean? What are the categorizations of risk? Is it a reputational risk? Is it a legal risk? Is it a financial risk? Like, what do these terms actually mean? Write it down. Get everybody to sign off on that. And the reason that that's so important before going any further, that's what your board expects. That's what your investors expect. That's what your C-level executives who you bring in, that's what they're going to expect. Because the thing that I've seen pervasively is if the CEO thinks that a high-level financial impact is going to be $1 million and the CFO thinks it's going to be $250,000, right? You can't have a meaningful conversation over risk tolerances at all. And I've seen this in 10-person companies. I have seen this in Fortune 10 companies. It runs the gamut. If you don't get the risks written down, agreed upon with standardized definitions, stop. Don't bother going any further. But also get this baked in as early as possible culturally, because companies don't like having conversations about risks. It's an uncomfortable conversation.
Kane, let's learn a bit more about you. I've got a list of 35 questions here. The good news is I'm not asking you 35 questions. I'm going to ask you to pick three numbers between 1 and 35.
Let's go with number 8.
Number 8 is tricked out Jeep or German car with all the gadgets?
Probably a Jeep if it can get up to Mount Baker. That would be favorite.
Tell me about Mount Baker.
Mount Baker is our, let's see now. This is a nationally syndicated podcast. Rains all the time. Worst ski hill ever. Never show up there. It's green. It rains. It's full of rocks. Absolutely terrible. And all the locals will tell you that. And anything you see about world record snowfall is an absolute lie.
Which part of the country is this?
Bellingham, Washington, okay. The city of subdued excitement. Kind of closer to Vancouver, Canada than to Seattle, Washington.
Got it. So Mount Baker's wet, which is why you need a Jeep to get up there. Is that what you're telling me?
Oh, definitely. Yes. That's what we do in the winter. I'm an avid snowboarder for the past 30 years now, I think. And yes, definitely. It's very wet up there. Don't go. And certainly don't buy your season's passes.
Yeah, I'm lucky enough to live in Colorado. So we usually get good snow here every year. We've had a couple of winters where it lasts good. Never as bad as some of the unfortunate winters in Tahoe. I know they've suffered a little bit in the last 10, 15 years, but we do pretty well here. But it always seems like Utah is the one where they talk about truly getting the big powder and the huge dumps and, you know, many, many, many feet every year. So I'm kind of jealous of Utah.
Yeah, you get that really light, fluffy snow. We get what we call cascade concrete, which is it's a distinct experience. It's kind of like mashed potatoes.
All right. Next number, team 1 in 35.
Let's go with 27.
27. Cats or dogs?
Cats.
Oh, that was a quick answer.
easy question. Yeah, that was, I'm looking at one right over there, actually. My Norwegian forest cat, who last year appeared in the company commercial, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He's on, sometimes people will walk up to our booth still at events and see the cat video and just be entranced by that. And they'll like go, oh, wait, is your cat here? And now we're actually debating if he wants to come to conferences with me.
Yep, there he is. So hold up. We want a guest appearance real quick.
Go on then. Come on.
All right. Come here, Modi. Be on camera. He's like, wait, what?
Okay. It's like, I haven't done my makeup.
Norwegian forest cat.
Oh, big and fluffy.
Yeah, they're very small. He doesn't actually fit on screen. Yeah, he's 2 years old, and they grow to be about 20 to 25 pounds. So he is about 17 pounds, would you say? Yeah, about 17 pounds. So he's still got some growing left to do.
Now, how did he end up in the company video?
I suggested that it would be a fun twist to put him in, and the editing team decided, hey, why not? Let's see if that works. And he's just got a natural talent for theater, it turns out. He admittedly, a lot of the time he spent in the dressing room until it was time for him to go on camera, and he just knocked it out of the park when he got on stage.
You know, listeners of the podcast will know that I've been on various rants over the years about how cybersecurity companies need to be bolder and do things differently, right? When they go out there in the market, you can't just be giving boring value props to people all the time. And I'm always looking for people that just try something different, just something, right? So it might stand out. And it sounds like your cat might be starring in the world of cybersecurity vendor videos.
He has been. Yes, indeed.
All right. Last number, team, 1 in 36, sorry.
Let's go with 19.
19 is GIF or GIF?
Oh, dear me. Are we allowed to be friends after we have this conversation?
Well, it all depends on your answer. This can be cut short very quickly.
Oh, dear me. Loaded question. So I go with GIF, even though my kids absolutely relentlessly mock me for that one. I go with GIF because that's how I heard it pronounced when I first came out. And it's one of those historical anachronisms, I'd say, more than anything else.
It's one of these things where people have strong opinions about which way it should be, but for no good reason.
Uh-huh. Yep.
I've never heard anyone give a logical reason why one or other is the right way to do it. But yeah, so you're a GIF guy, which is fair enough.
I am. Yeah, you have animated GIFs.
Yeah, let's try to make this real for Cyber Donut then. I mean, this is a company, let's say they're based on some of the East Coast of the U.S. Tornado is not really their thing. But what might be examples of the type of things they should be thinking about that's relevant for a software development company, essentially, right, with 50 employees, 5 to 8 sales reps?
So I think one of the risks, there are possibly many of those risks. One would be the loss of intellectual property more than anything else. I think that's one of those, because if you lose your intellectual property, whether through corporate espionage or whether through denial of service that you can't actually get it at your platform anymore because somebody's like taken over it, that becomes a risk. And it's a business risk, ultimately, in that you can't do business at that point. Another risk to consider would be the loss of all of your data. And that's especially important if you are processing data, especially for either California citizens or more pointedly EU citizens, because privacy risks associated with the loss of all of the personal identifiable information that companies have, that becomes a regulatory risk. And it also becomes a reputational risk. And you can, of course, you know, stack rank those as you like. And then for a software development company, the other thing that comes to mind is financial impact risks. Like if you have a cyber incident that were to cause a, you know, your workforce to be working on that as opposed to building software, right? Because a breach is going to suck up time. A breach is going to suck up resources. And that means your engineering resources, instead of dealing with building new product, they are going to be dealing with cleaning up mess and trying to perhaps rebuild their infrastructure. Again, that's a risk that we have to consider, because that's going to decelerate any product development we had. So if you had a contractual obligation that says, we're going to deliver this feature by this day, right? Companies do that all the time. And you have a breach, your risk becomes you're going to miss contractual obligations that you have to your existing customers. So it's those levels of risk and more that companies have to document and then decide, how comfortable are we with that? Some companies will be fine. Like, yeah, we might miss a date. That's okay, right? But if our reputation gets absolutely damaged, maybe that's not okay. And that helps assess how those risks will be treated.
That feels like a much higher level discussion than your first step around, you know, a framework to work off. Who usually would look to drive this inside the company?
You know, it's going to be whoever owns risk ultimately inside of the company, because they're also going to become the first person who operates this risk program. I've seen that more often than not be the CFO, just because that tends to be their core skill set and their aptitude. Outside of that, if you've got internal counsel, they might be able to do it. If you've got external counsel, then you're paying through the nose to do it, and I wouldn't recommend that. I think it's most commonly the CFO or somebody with that background.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so they go to drive this at the executive level to have, you know, discussions about the company, which are, you know, is kind of fundamental to what the company's all about, it seems like, right?
Yeah, and also the investors will want to know, what are the risks that are facing your business? And some of those are going to be, you know, your traditional like market competition or expansion into new territories. And some of those are going to have cyber elements like, you know, increased risk of regulatory oversight resulting from a breach.
So what's step three?
So step one was we got ourselves some basic table stakes controls. And two is we've figured out what are our risks, right? So this becomes now a decision point for companies, is do we have a reason to go get an external attestation that's going to help us create some trust and to smooth our sales cycles instead of spending our time filling out endless security questionnaires? And this is something that the MSSP that you're working with, maybe they've got like a virtual CISO, a vCISO, to actually do that initial uplift. Because if you can say, here are the business risks that we have and select controls to mitigate those business risks. And if those just happen to nicely align to something like to a SOC 2 or something heavier like an ISO 27001, if you can get there, if you can make that business case, then the outcome becomes you can build something like a trust center. So when a company comes, a prospect says, well, you know, we have this miserable 1,200 question SIG that we've let know. You don't need to fill it out, actually. And the reason why is here's all the answers on our trust center, or here is our SOC 2 type 2, or here is our ISO 27001 attestation. And that really is going to reduce the amount of friction associated with sales cycles from a lack of trust.
And anyone who's on the podcast who's been in sales at a company early stage, you'll know when you get that vendor questionnaire through and it's, you know, 40 pages and 750 questions, you know, trying to get the resources to work on that, it better be a big deal, right? But sometimes, unfortunately, just working in like your entry, your land deal at a big company requires that level of effort to go through. So I really like the idea of the trust center where you can collect these artifacts, right? So you can at least try and take control of the conversation and say, look, here's what you can get from where we are right now. We want to work with your questionnaire and things like that. But first of all, let's look at what we have and see what if this satisfies your requirements, right? Some companies will actually gladly work with that. You'll probably still get the the big financials will say it's my way or the highway kind of thing, right? And you'll have to sit there and do the translation. But I do like the idea of the trust center.
But it also gets us ahead of the conversation. So the thing that I've learned and the thing that I've heard consistently from other field CISOs is the person who offers first probably is going to win that negotiation. And so if you wait for a prospect to say, here is our questionnaire, and it's this miserable online portal that has an unknown number of branching questions that you're going to have to fill out, it's going to suck to be you. If, on the other hand, you say, look, here is all of our proof that we are doing the cybers okay, they might come back and have missed that and say, well, we still want to send a person to come. Like, I was talking to a friend of mine. They have an ISO 27001 certification. They wanted the prospect wanted to send a person to their office. They have a virtual office. And like nobody works there. It's just like they have some leased office space. And they said, we're going to send a person and they're going to do an assessment. And the conversation comes, okay, so you think in 4-hour conversation, you're going to do better than an ISO auditor who spent 3 weeks with us? Are you actually like, are you feeling okay? Do you understand how this thing works? And sometimes that's necessary. Now, like you say, occasionally financial companies or other companies that are highly risk averse are going to still demand to do that, but it reduces that to a manageable level. So instead of having to deal with like one questionnaire per deal on every deal, it becomes the exception, not the norm. And I think that's where we need to move towards, because these security questionnaires, they don't necessarily mitigate risks. Right? That really depends on who's the person who filled it out and who's the person who read it. And I would posit that a lot of the activity that's happening right now on security questionnaires is not necessarily factual. And that is unintentional mistakes being made by either the people who are reading it and not understanding what they're reading, or the people who are filling it out, not understanding what they're filling out because of a lack of alignment. Or there's one example where I saw a security questionnaire that asked for a tape backup strategy. I'm sorry, like the 1990s want that question back because it belongs there. Nobody's doing that anymore.
Yeah, I heard someone in the third-party risk management space say that the only people that actually really want the spreadsheets are the people that created them in the first place, because it gives them the job, right? Everyone else kind of defaults to it because they haven't got a better solution. So when a better solution comes along, they're like, oh, no, we're good with that. You got your SOC 2 and you got your ISO. Sure, let's at least start there, right?
Exactly. It then allows them to focus on. And the other thing I'd say as well, and this is something that even startups, because we all also purchase software and services from other companies, please risk rank your companies that you're doing business with. Like, do not send the giant security questionnaire beast to somebody else if they are a low risk. Like, if they're going to be doing your landscaping, for example, or if they're going to be doing a marketing campaign where they have no access to your data and only are using your brand, like, they should have a considerably lower rank in risk and have a lower treatment on setting up a deal with them than somebody who's going to be processing and have access to all of your corporate data and maybe be at risk of exfiltration.
Right. So you have to do it appropriately. I remember back in the day, 10 years ago, I was working at a company and we had to educate that we weren't a data processor, right? So they would give us, first of all, the agreement that they wanted us to sign was all based around being a data processor. So there was whole swathes of it, which you had to red line X just and apply. So there's always that discussion and argument about what should apply and not. And same on the questionnaire side, right? It just seems just complete overkill for depending on what your solution does.
But just to bring it back to cyber donuts, so if they were to follow that the very high level three steps, they're going to get faster sales cycles and they're going to have a better understanding of corporate risks and what business risks they're facing, whether they communicate that to their board or their investors or internally. And finally, they've got like the base foundation for cybersecurity in place. But it has taken it away from that conversation of this is a cost center. This is, in fact, a very close alignment with the go-to-market team. This is a competitive differentiator rather than something that nobody wants and that we all have to do.
Let me inject another phrase I've heard that perhaps is maybe misunderstood in the sales side, which is SOC 2. It seems to be, oh, we got our SOC 2, or we don't have our SOC 2, or they're asking about our SOC 2. Let's peel that back a bit. What the heck is a SOC 2, and where would it fit into your framework here, your three steps?
It would fit into the second step. And so a SOC 2 is a report that you're operating your controls as they are written on a consistent basis. I think that's neat, except for what are your controls, right? And that's where there's some definite like interpretation associated with it, because they only measure the controls that you're operating. So if your controls are based on what Joe in the basement came up with, right, you're first of all going to have a harder time, but also you're going to have a more inconsistent way of communicating that outwards. Now, if you've got controls based on something reputable, like, I don't know, AI CPAs, SOC 2, like illustrative controls that they have, or if you've got them based on that and CIS, CSC implementation group 1, then if you are asked for a copy of the auditor's report, which tends to be what the more demanding clients and prospects will ask for, then they can actually see which controls you are operating and they can go, oh, these actually do look like reasonable controls, like reasonably operated. I'm going to set aside control design for a whole other conversation, because there's, you know, 6 hours of our life we'll never get back. But at least they can go, oh, yeah, these are common controls. We understand these. These seem normal.
And are they aligned to cloud in some way for SOC 2, or is it?
They don't necessarily have to be cloud aligned, no.
Okay. And then when we're thinking about tools to help people go through the process and get to the point, and then I guess monitor and keep growing from there on, where does Hyperproof fit into this whole process?
So it's the recognition that as a cybersecurity, or as any startup grows ultimately, or as any business grows, the number of audits that we're going to face, whether they're contractual audits or whether they're regulatory or managing external attestations on an annualized basis, that's only going to accelerate. And the period of, you know, the amount of people that you want to have spend doing that, you don't want to necessarily staff your way out of this problem. Right. I think that the other thing that comes to mind is if we've had that good conversation early on about risk and we selected our controls based on our risk, if you can then measure the effectiveness of the control operation on a continuous basis, you have a higher degree of confidence that you're actually effectively burning down your risks. So, for example, if you have a risk that is maybe, I don't know, data exfiltration, and you check that you've got a control of data loss prevention, so people can't just upload stuff to the cloud and YOLO it, right? And you measure that once a year. That, to me, says the other 364 days, you had no visibility operationally into how effectively you were mitigating the risk of data exfiltration, which, if that's one of your company's risks, it's the loss of your intellectual property, that would be concerning to me as a CISO, or as anybody who manages risk. And so by being able to continuously evaluate how effectively a control is operating and test it on an ongoing basis, we get that confidence that we are effectively managing our risk. And if a new risk comes up, we can then, because we have a control inventory, say, oh, well, we don't need new controls for this one. We've already got it. Or if you get a new regulatory requirement, maybe you've got SOC 2 and you choose, well, you know what, we want to get ISO. Right? Then you can see which of your controls do you currently have based on the risks that you currently have, and align in any additional ones, reuse as many of those controls and that evidence that you've been automatically collecting as feasible, rather than going, oh, shoot, it's a new one. We have to do this big gap analysis. Like I used to, when I did consulting, we made bank on gap analysis, right? It's something you can, if you've got your own control inventory, if you've got your own risk register, you don't need a company to go do a gap analysis for you. And that's kind of the premise behind Hyperproof, in that it allows companies to get those consolidated inventories of all of your proof of or evidence, all of your controls, all of your risks, so that businesses can talk about it, and then to automatically collect and inspect it so that we get that real-time dashboard view of how effectively we're managing our risks. Now, it is a GRC software solution. I tend to think primarily in risk, so I've probably over-rotated into R, but nobody selects controls because they're fun, and nobody does governance because they're fun, and nobody does compliance because it's the best thing ever. We do it to manage our business risks.
Well, I think that's an important point. I mean, I think that it takes Cyber Donut, right? They're probably really scrappy in a whole bunch of different areas, right? They're getting by. They're happy they got 20 customers. They're trying to think, how do we get to 50? You know, they've got some processes in place, but at the end of the day, they're still in that scrappy mode. I remember the CEO at Okta said that he believed their revenue was pretty fragile up until about 3 million ARR, right? So I imagine Cyber Donut's in that realm. But to me, this is part of growing up a little bit, right? In that, if you really want to turn this from a cost center into a profit center and help you differentiate and drive sales, you want to do more than just go out there and just get a SOC 2, right? And this is going to give you the foundations, if you do it right, to to maybe not overhire, right, in an area, not throw a bunch of bodies at it, not have to go to externals to come in and do a whole bunch of work that gets very expensive, but give you the foundation that you can actually win some deals and then grow from there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's that continuous alignment with go-to-market, because when a startup, like as you move from, I don't know, angel investing through Series D, for example, it's not like the go-to-market alignment should go away. It should only become more tightly enmeshed there, so that the security team, you, even if you've in-housed it at some point, like you have your own FTEs dedicated for cybersecurity, they should maintain that relationship to understand, like, here are the contractual terms that we're willing to accept that are going to be an easy thing. Here are the things that we should avoid. Like, if you see this in here, this is a straight up deal killer. If they're asking us for, I don't know, $10 million in cyber insurance, just go ahead. Don't bother pursuing that deal, because they are not a reasonable prospect that we want to do business with. And it's those, like, that continuous conversation. And I think that's also endemically been missed in cybersecurity for decades now, where there hasn't been that close alignment with go-to-market. And that's where, why we are where we are today.
Yeah, I think that connection is so crucial. And you know, ask any salesperson, you know, do we need to do this sort of stuff? And they'll go, oh, I don't know, I'd rather get more leads, until they get an opportunity that doesn't go any further because you don't have this in place. And then they'll go, I wish we'd done the program, right?
Definitely.
Well, Kane, listen, I've really enjoyed the conversation. If someone wants to get in touch with you and talk about what you're doing, or if they've got events that they think you might be a good fit for, what's the best way to get hold of you?
Sure. So the best way to get a hold of me is on LinkedIn. I am Kane McGladrey. On Twitter, or X or whatever, I'm Kane McGladrey on that as well. Although I keep evaluating, like, where does this fit in anymore? And if you're interested in learning about Hyperproof, we are at hyperproof.io. And also, if they want to see anything else, check out Drafting Compliance on YouTube, on our YouTube channel. Or if you want to learn, that's if you want to learn about why I don't drink beer and why we're doing FedRAMP. That's where we talk about that. Or if you want a news summary, check Kane's Top 5 and 5 on YouTube as well.
So beer and FedRAMP, that's quite the spectrum right there.
It certainly is. And I am not a beer drinker, but it's part of the show. We evaluate FedRAMP controls too.
Very good. Well, listen, I wish you every success for the rest of this year and into 24. It's a great time to be in this whole area right now. So I wish you and the company everything, that all good success.
Thanks so much, Andrew. Thank you for having me on the show.
It would mean a lot to me and to the continued growth of the show if you'd help get the word out. So how do you do that easily? There are two ways. Firstly, just simply send a link to a friend. Send a link to the show, to this episode. You can email it, text it, Slack it, whatever works for you and is easy for you. The second way is to leave a super quick rating. And sometimes that can seem complicated, so I've made it as easy for you as I can. You simply have to go to ratethispodcast.com/cyber. That's ratethispodcast.com/cyber, and explains exactly how to do it. Either of these ways will take you less than 30 seconds to do, and it will mean the world to me. So thank you.